Chapter 36. Before evaluating the most plausible account of how Marilyn Monroe died on August 4, 1962, one question about this true crime mystery must be addressed in full based on all of the facts presented in this book, many of them for the first time. That question is, did Robert F. Kennedy cause Marilyn's death either by his being directly involved or through operatives who handled the chore for him? Certainly, RFK is not the only suspect in her death. No question exists that others could have orchestrated it. For instance, as noted, underworld figures may have been involved as they attempted to embarrass the Kennedys by securing Marilyn's secret diaries. Another alternative is that FBI agents or rogue federal agents may have been exceedingly troubled by what President Kennedy or the Attorney General may have told Marilyn about Hoover's ties to organized crime. The CIA or other rogue governmental operatives may have been concerned about what she might divulge regarding the fixing of the 1960 presidential election. The UFO encounters JFK may have confided to her could possibly have alerted military intelligence operatives to the danger of disclosure. All of these players surrounding her world and the Kennedys' world would have learned of her threats to go public, to expose secrets that had to remain secret, putting Marilyn in danger. Returning to how Dorothy Kilgallen would have investigated Marilyn's death, it seems likely that, having dissected and probably dismissed the mob theory, as well as the others, for any number of reasons, the revered reporter would have returned to the Kennedy fold, recalling what she had written of the Marilyn Bobby affair and her belief that the last phone call to Marilyn was initiated by RFK. Granting as much, then investigating Bobby would have been a priority, especially when dealing specifically with motive and benefit from the crime. Early on in his life, RFK had been known only as JFK's little brother, even to the extent of being considered the runt of the Kennedy litter, of whom expectations were minimal. In 1952, shortly after graduating from the University of Virginia School of Law, Kennedy secured one of his first jobs thanks to an old family friend, Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy. He had vacationed with the Kennedy family and even dated two of Bobby's sisters before agreeing to hire the young lawyer to work on his permanent subcommittee on investigations examining possible communist infiltration of the U.S. government. Bobby Kennedy never completely disavowed McCarthy's Cold War Red Scare policies. In fact, he named the despicable McCarthy godfather to his first child, Kathleen. Even associating with a man like McCarthy, a liar of the first degree filled with hatred in his heart, who blacklisted as many as he could regardless of evidence, which in effect destroyed lives, gives substantial insight into the kind of person RFK then aspired to be. RFK looked at the end, not the means, when trying to get what he wanted. Such behavior characterizes, once again, a man with little or no moral or ethical compass. The next rung in RFK's ladder to the top conveniently appeared when Papa Joe weaseled him into the position of a big shot on the McClellan Committee probing the mob. During those hearings, RFK took the opportunity, of which there were many, to scream at the mobsters, calling them every name he could think of and making fun of them, as when Bobby scolded Sam Giancana by saying to him, "I thought only little girls giggled." Without question, Kilgallen would have realized that Bobby made enemies for not only himself but for JFK, and one did not want these dangerous men as enemies since they had their own rules regarding disobedience. When RFK was appointed Attorney General, Kilgallen must have been as shocked as everyone else, although possibly she wasn't, since, as all those familiar with the Kennedys knew, when Joe Kennedy wanted something done, it was done. As Kennedy family confidant John Siegenthaler recalled, his account is in this book's introduction, Joe ordered JFK to appoint Bobby Attorney General. From the day he took office, his reckless conduct became a given not only in JFK's world, but in Marilyn's and Kilgallen's as well. Most assuredly, the moral and ethical rules of the game that RFK learned from his father became the cornerstone of Bobby's character as he attempted to prove to the world he was worthy of being Attorney General. Without question, Joe had played both sides of the law in order to amass a fortune and become one of the most elite power brokers in the world. Based on mountains of credible research for their 1984 book, The Kennedys, Peter Collier and David Horowitz wrote, "Rumors of numerous extramarital affairs, illicit business dealings, and even ties to crime only added a piquant touch of mystery to his reputation and made Joe seem all the more romantic, Gatsby-esque." Father Joe had been fixing elections extending back to his early days in Boston. In fact, Evelyn Lincoln, President Kennedy's secretary, admitted to Seymour Hersh in The Dark Side of Camelot, "I know they bought the 1960 election." After that election, Sam Giancana celebrated. To his close friends, he said, "If I can't be president, at least I can own one." Joe the Womanizer was, without doubt, the predecessor to JFK and RFK the Womanizers. Like father, like sons, carbon copies of their father. As noted, while these characterizations shed light on the flawed man who poured into his sons everything he learned and wished for himself, Joseph Kennedy's 738-page FBI file, hidden from view for years and then heavily redacted, provides more information about who Joe really was, a scoundrel of the first degree, especially when it came to the treatment of women. He, in turn, taught his sons, from JFK to RFK to Teddy, to be scoundrels as well, ones who had no respect for the fair sex, none at all, including, of course, their wives. Certainly Ted's handling of the Mary Jo Kopechne drowning was symbolic of the selfish, me-first mentality of the Kennedys, especially RFK. Mobster reactions to RFK's appointment to Attorney General included the quote from San Giancana to his associates, "That rat bastard Joe, son of a bitch. We broke our balls for him, JFK, and gave him the election, and he gets his brother Bobby to hound us to death." Giancana's daughter Antoinette said, "When Sam learned that Robert F. Kennedy had been appointed Attorney General, he felt it was a rabbit punch in the dark." Furious at RFK's actions when he started hounding Carlos Marcello, Giancana roared, "Bobby's the worst of the bunch. He's a troublemaker for sure. A cocky greenhorn little bastard who's too big for his effin' britches. Hey, don't worry about him. I'll cut him down to size." After taking office as Attorney General, RFK became obsessed with proving that his brother, the president, had made the right decision. Despite having never tried a criminal case, or, for that matter, engaged in any real practice of law, Bobby was determined to also prove to his brother and to his father that he was up to the task. Echoing Joe's way of doing business, which meant playing both sides of the fence regarding what was lawful and what was not, one of RFK's first orders of business, as noted, had been to deport New Orleans Don Carlos Marcello to Central America. Marcello's lawyers cried foul, and even the New York Times denounced Bobby's actions, calling them against the law. But RFK didn't care. The action made headlines, and Bobby was now the big shot, one whom Joe was already grooming to run for president when JFK's term ended. All would have been well, but Giancana, through Marcello's operation, made good on his pledge to cut Bobby down to size. This came about in a way that was even worse than RFK could ever have expected, resulting in JFK's assassination. In effect, Bobby, and of course Joe, had killed JFK even though they had never fired a bullet. Just as Carlos Marcello had eliminated JFK so as to make Bobby powerless when the Mafia Don's back was against the wall in late 1963 as he faced deportation and criminal charges, RFK must have had the same mindset when Marilyn Monroe threatened to call a news conference, perhaps with Joe DiMaggio at her side, and not only expose the infidelities of him and his brother, but perhaps national security matters as well, including JFK's obsession with UFOs. One may only imagine the bombshell effect of potential headlines that would follow. Marilyn tells all. JFK, RFK love affairs. National security secrets divulged. President's obsession with UFOs during pillow talk. Such disclosures would have sent shockwaves through the universe, but those hurt the worst with the disclosures would have been Jackie, Ethel, and the children, as well as others in the Kennedy family, including Rose. In effect, Bobby, realizing the possible effect of Marilyn's disclosures, must have believed he had no choice but to somehow silence her, because he, like Joe before him, lived by a separate set of rules, with abiding by the law being secondary to what was necessary. He thus would clean up the mess with Marilyn, likely gaining the approval of his brother and father, the most important approvals he always needed. When considering this aspect of RFK's character, one must take into account that besides being Attorney General, RFK had become the vacuum cleaner, as noted, for all of JFK's marital transgressions. Recall that Kilgallen's rival columnist Earl Wilson called RFK the Kennedy family's sexual policeman. Now he had to police himself, attempting to clean up the mess he had made by having an affair with arguably the most famous woman in the world at the time. Being basically a coward in the ilk of his father, RFK would never have had the guts to poison Marilyn on his own initiative. That meant he had, it would seem, two choices: either enlist operatives to do it, or engage through an intermediary, perhaps Greenson or Engelberg, to do it for him. The most likely candidate on the surface regarding the latter proposition appears to have been Dr. Ralph Greenson. He certainly had the means and opportunity to get close to Marilyn, and she appeared to trust him more than Dr. Engelberg. Recall what author Frank Capel wrote in The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe regarding the question of the amount of drugs Marilyn possessed on the day of her death. He wrote, "Dr. Greenson gave Marilyn a prescription of 25 capsules of Phenergan in 25 milligram strength. This is an antihistamine drug, often used for allergy. He also gave her a prescription of 25 Nembutal capsules in 1 1/2 grain strength. The prescriptions were dated August 3, 1962, and were filled by the Vincente Pharmacy, 12025 San Vicente Boulevard, Los Angeles. They assigned number 20857 to the Phenergan prescription and number 20858 to the Nembutal prescription." Capel added, "Dr. Engelberg told the police on August 5th, and their report shows that he had prescribed a refill of Nembutal about 2 days ago, and that there should have been about 50 capsules at the time of the refill. This is completely false. The prescription I found was dated August 3, 1962, and it called for only 25 capsules. It was not a refill since it was given a new number." Regarding Dr. Greenson, Capel then wrote, "He painted a different picture when he was questioned by police. The police report shows Dr. Greenson had seen the deceased on August 4, 1962, Saturday, at 5:15 p.m., at her request, because she was unable to sleep. He had been treating her for about 1 year." Capel commented, "Why she should want to go to sleep at 5:15 p.m. in the afternoon, he did not say, nor would it seem logical for her to want to go to sleep since she had a guest, Pat Newcomb, with her." In explaining a bill of $1,400 submitted to Marilyn's estate for payment, Dr. Greenson had this to say: "All office visits lasted a minimum of 1.5 hours. All visits to the home were approximately 2 hours in duration." A portion of the invoice Greenson sent to Marilyn's law firm and then filed in court, attempting to be paid for time spent with his famous patient, is revealing. Although the typing is somewhat fuzzy, notice the final entry indicates, "Saturday, August 4, patient's home." Playing amateur sleuth, Capel then wrote, "If we are to accept Dr. Greenson's story, he would have been trying to put Marilyn to sleep while she and Pat Newcomb were enjoying each other's company, and Marilyn was in a good mood, a happy mood, as stated by Miss Newcomb, who did not leave until 6:30 p.m., and makes no mention of seeing any psychiatrist trying to put Marilyn to sleep. To the contrary, Marilyn told Newcomb, 'I'll see you tomorrow, Toodaloo. Of interest is that Greenson's sister was married to heavyweight attorney Mickey Rudin, whose law firm, Gang, Tire, Rudin, and Brown, received Greenson's bill for services rendered. Furthermore, one of Rudin's main clients was Frank Sinatra, who had played a role in the Marilyn saga as her lover and who was also a patient of Dr. Greenson. According to Capel, apparently Dr. Greenson's wife Hildy and daughter Joan helped coach Marilyn regarding what subjects she could discuss with Bobby Kennedy when they met or spoke on the telephone. This was done so she could make a favorable impression and to appear confident while talking to him about a multitude of current events. Greenson was thus aware of Marilyn's affection for the Attorney General, as were many others who knew her well, but quite revealing is the fact that Marilyn cared for RFK so much that she was prepping for their time together so she could impress him with her intellect. Based on interviews with Dr. Greenson's friends, he was, as could be expected, quite upset over Marilyn's passing. But the question remains whether he was upset simply because she was dead or because he had a hand in that death due to his having poisoned her, either deliberately on his own, accidentally on purpose, or deliberately at the behest of others who wanted her death to look like a suicide. During any investigation Dorothy Kilgallen would have launched, she certainly would have wondered about another strange factor in Marilyn's death, the mysterious presence of the drug chloral hydrate in the movie star's liver, according to the autopsy. The presence of this drug certainly baffled Dr. Engelberg, since he later stated in an interview with the Los Angeles Examiner, "I never gave her chloral hydrate, and I don't think any doctor in the United States gave it to her." This statement, strange in nature since research has shown that the drug was apparently available at the time, may in fact, as will be shown, be the most important clue to exactly how Marilyn died, a clue many have completely overlooked in the proper context during the 6 decades and counting since the movie star passed away. In essence, chloral hydrate, C2H3Cl3O2, mixed with alcohol, is also known as a Mickey Finn, also known as a Mickey, or knockout drops. The hypnotic effect acts to slow down the central nervous system and brain activity. This causes extreme drowsiness and deep sleep, usually within an hour, dependent on the dosage, making it a potent date rape drug. Toxicologists are still mystified by exactly how the drug works. Some theorize that it metabolizes into trichloral ethanol. This causes the sedative effect and is responsible for chloral hydrate's physiological and psychological effects. Normal dosage is 500 milligrams to 1 gram when the drug is a sleep aid at bedtime. Effects vary with body weight and food ingested. Prescription chloral hydrate comes in capsules of different doses. Homemade chloral hydrate is a clear liquid with a bitter taste. The usual lethal dose is 10 grams, but as few as 4 are dangerous. The drug's effect can last for several hours, dependent on dosage. The Food and Drug Administration classifies chloral hydrate as a Schedule 4 controlled substance. Warnings abound that the drug should not be mixed with alcohol. The combination of the two exacerbates the effect. Dependent, again, on dosage, chloral hydrate's side effects include droopy eyelids, headache, vertigo, drowsiness, sleepiness, confusion, and disorientation. It also causes shallow breathing, faintness, weakness, and uneven heartbeat, leading to death if the dosage is excessive. This said, if the chloral hydrate intake was part of the means by which Marilyn died, who provided the dangerous drug if it was not Dr. Engelberg? One may suggest that RFK's operatives took action at some point, perhaps with Dr. Greenson, a potential Judas in the ilk as was Ron Paddocky in Kilgallen's death, being involved, but there is more to the story, as will be revealed. Regardless, the substance of a taped phone conversation with the psychiatrist, who he is speaking to is unknown, certainly a vital clue about Marilyn's death, appears to incriminate the one man who had the strongest motive to eliminate Marilyn and the most to gain from her death. Dr. Greenson, during the call, said, I can't explain myself or defend myself without revealing things I don't want to reveal. You can't draw a line and say, I'll tell you this, but I won't tell you that. It's a terrible position to be in to have to say I can't talk about it because I can't tell the whole story. Greenson, if he is to be believed, then ended the call with as close to a smoking gun as is possible in the Maryland murder by stating, apparently in answer to a question about providing more facts regarding what happened, listen, talk to Bobby Kennedy. There was no follow-up, and the video screen went blank, causing one to wonder why Greenson had made such a shocking statement and whether he was telling the truth that any investigation of Marilyn's death should begin, and perhaps end, by speaking to RFK. The revelation by Greenson, if true, and there are many researchers who believe it is too good to be true, points to the potential that RFK, either on his own or through intermediaries, could have squeezed Greenson, whom former patient and noted screenwriter and filmmaker Gary Kaskell told this author was an arrogant jerk, into becoming an operative in the death of Marilyn. Perhaps Greenson was threatened with exposure of some evil deed he had done, paid a large amount of money to cooperate, or enticed in another manner so that he compromised himself and aided in the elimination of the one woman in the world Bobby Kennedy feared more than any other. Doing so would be reminiscent of how Paddocky had apparently been squeezed by the wrong people to rat on Kilgallen by divulging her JFK assassination investigation evidence, which led directly to her murder, to being dead, as the Las Vegas-based primary source indicated to this author. Despite considerable research, little information is available in any reputable sources regarding the life and times of Greenson during the 17 years he lived after Marilyn died. Whether he may have been paid off or favored by the Kennedy clan or anyone else associated with Marilyn's death is thus unknown, since those investigating apparently never dove into his finances or paid attention to a change in lifestyle. Of interest regarding the Greenson-RFK connection, recall that Lynn Franklin, the Beverly Hills police officer who stopped Peter Lawford's speeding car the night Marilyn died, stated that the passenger in the front seat, Bobby was in the back, was Dr. Greenson. With this in mind, suspicions that his "listen, talk to Bobby Kennedy" statement may be too good to be true remain understandable, but when considered in the context of the plethora of credible evidence, among others, presented in this book regarding RFK's complicity in Marilyn's death, including the Capel book revelations, the Giles book's solid research, and the Donaldson article's obvious reference to Bobby, Greenson's eerie statement gains believability. If Dorothy Kilgallen had investigated Marilyn's death to the full extent of her skills, she certainly would have probed what happened to the death scene before Engelberg and Greenson arrived at Marilyn's home. Since there was no real investigation of that bedroom death scene, a search was never performed for fingerprints or other items of interest or the possibility of wood shavings or other Jimmy marks around the window panes indicating someone had broken into the bedroom before Dr. Greenson or Dr. Engelberg did, so such evidence was never secured. The absence of any drinking glass alongside the empty pill bottles also remains a curious fact. Recall that analysis of the glass recovered on the night table beside Kilgallen's bed turned her case completely around, since remnants of Nembutal were discovered on the rim of that glass. This, in turn, meant that someone, likely not Kilgallen, had emptied the capsules containing the three barbiturates into whatever liquid was in that glass, probably vodka and tonic, Kilgallen's preferred drink, pointing away from accidental overdose and toward a homicide. Amazingly enough, a simple glass, one discovered in Kilgallen's case, and the absence of a glass found in Marilyn's case, connect these two amazing women when it comes to cause of death. In addition, rush to judgment that each had died by their own hand, Kilgallen accidentally overdosing, circumstances undetermined, and Marilyn committing what was dubbed probable suicide trigger yet another comparison. It is certainly an unfortunate one, since the glass or absence of a glass was a substantial clue that a dogged reporter like Kilgallen would have investigated, both in her own case and especially in Marilyn's case, since her swallowing the enormous amount of Nembutal pills without water appears to be scientifically impossible. Before assessing additional facts as to how Marilyn died, a return to the Rothberg report, as noted in the FBI memo of August 3, 1962, provides a possible courtroom closing argument for solving the puzzle as to why Marilyn had to be eliminated. The first portion of the memo, posted the day before Marilyn was pronounced dead, contains these disclosures. Wiretap of telephone conversation between reporter Dorothy Kilgallen and a close friend, Howard Rothberg, A., from wiretap of telephone conversation of Marilyn Monroe and Attorney General Robert Kennedy, B., appraisal of content. Breaking down the FBI posting, factors to consider are: either Rothberg's or Kilgallen's phone was tapped at the time, or both were. Since Kilgallen was the more famous of the two, it seems logical to believe it was her phone that was tapped. No evidence exists as to why Kilgallen's phone was tapped at the time, since this was 1 year and change from when she became of interest to the FBI in light of her investigation of JFK's assassination. If it was Rothberg's phone that was tapped, there is no indication as to why this happened. Since the substance of the conversations between Rothberg and Kilgallen ended up being posted in an FBI memo, it must have been the government that was behind the wiretaps, arguably at the behest of J. Edgar Hoover. It seems that it was Rothberg who had knowledge of Marilyn's phone conversations with Robert Kennedy without there being a factual basis for his having access to this information, other than that he dealt with photographers of Marilyn. If Rothberg received this information from the photographers, why would Marilyn have trusted them with the facts about her conversations with RFK? No information exists as to what Kilgallen did with the information Rothberg gave to her, since research indicates it apparently never appeared in print. That the information passed from Rothberg to Kilgallen appeared in the FBI memo 1 day before Marilyn died logically points to the Marilyn-RFK conversation having happened quite recently, meaning that they spoke within days or hours of the posting. Mystery certainly abounds regarding all aspects of this part of the memo. Many of the questions it raises remain unanswered, since, once again, no investigation of Marilyn's death occurred, other than the perfunctory glance given by the L.A. police chief's minions concerning her mental state. Certainly, if any investigation had occurred, not only would the Rothberg-Kilgallen conversations have been of interest, but the disclosures following the first paragraph would have been bombshell evidence pointing to those who ended Marilyn's life. 1. Rothberg discussed the apparent of subject Marilyn with Kilgallen and the breakup with the Kennedys. Rothberg told Kilgallen that she, Marilyn, was attending Hollywood parties hosted by the inner circle among Hollywood's elite and was becoming the talk of the town again. Rothberg indicated in so many words that she, Marilyn, had secrets to tell, no doubt arising from her trysts with the president and the attorney general. One such secret mentions the visit by the president at a secret air base for purposes of inspecting things from outer space. Kilgallen replied that she knew what might be the source of visit. In the mid-50s, Kilgallen learned of secret effort by U.S. and U.K. governments to identify the origins of crashed spacecraft and dead bodies from a British government official. Kilgallen believed the story may have come from the indecipherable in the late 40s. Kilgallen said that if the story is true, it would cause terrible embarrassment to Jack Kennedy and his plans to have NASA put men on the moon. Of special interest here is another portion of the FBI memo. 1. Subject, Marilyn, repeatedly called the Attorney General and complained about the way she was being ignored by the President and his brother. 2. Subject threatened to hold a press conference and would tell all. 3. Subject made reference to bases in Cuba and knew of the President's plan to kill Castro. 4. Subject made reference to her diary of secrets and what the newspapers would do with such disclosures. Once again, breaking down the substance of the memo, if in fact it was accurate, strong evidence thus exists that 1. Marilyn was indeed involved in a romantic relationship with Attorney General Robert Kennedy. 2. Marilyn was calling RFK to express her complaints that she was being ignored by him as well as JFK. 3. Marilyn was intent on making good on her threats to go to the media with her secrets, confirming that she had first done so when she visited the Calneva Lodge the weekend before she died, as chronicled by Gianni Russo and Buddy Greco. 4. That the secrets involved Cuban affairs, especially the President's plan to kill Castro, which, if disclosed, would have been front-page news in every country in the world and a full-scale embarrassment to JFK. Again, what is unknown is when the Rothberg-Kilgallen conversation took place, but the fact that it was posted on the 3rd of August through the FBI memo means that if RFK had been warned by Marilyn in phone calls of her intention to tell all, she could never be allowed to go to the media with that information, just as Kilgallen could not be permitted to write her tell-all book for Random House, naming the one man responsible for orchestrating the JFK assassination, Marcello, and the one man who covered up the truth, Hoover. Close inspection of the final portion of the document reveals the following. Robert Kennedy has been having a romance and sex affair over a period of time with Marilyn Monroe. He had met her, the date being arranged by his sister and brother-in-law, Mr. and Mrs. Peter Lawford. Robert Kennedy had been spending much time in Hollywood during the last part of 1961 and early 1962 in connection with his trying to have a film made of his book dealing with crime investigations. He used to meet with producer Jerry Wald. He, Robert Kennedy, was reported to be intensely jealous of the fact that they had been making a film of John F. Kennedy's book of the P.T. Boat story. Robert Kennedy was deeply involved emotionally with Marilyn Monroe and had repeatedly promised to divorce his wife to marry Marilyn. Eventually, Marilyn realized that Bobby had no intention of marrying her, and about this time, 20th Century Fox Studio had decided to cancel her contract. She had become very unreliable, being late for set, etc. In addition, the studio was in financial difficulty due to the large expenditures caused in the filming of Cleopatra. The studio notified Marilyn that they were canceling her contract. This was right in the middle of a picture she was making. They decided to replace her with actress Lee Remick. Marilyn telephoned Robert Kennedy from her home in Brentwood, California, person to person, at the Department of Justice, Washington, D.C., to tell him the bad news. Robert Kennedy told her not to worry about the contract. He would take care of everything. When nothing was done, she again called him from her home to the Department of Justice, person to person, and on this occasion they had unpleasant words. Marilyn was reported to have threatened to make public their affair. The detail presented in this memo, if accurate, is impressive. How this information was collected, whether through wiretaps or otherwise, remains unknown, but common sense dictates that it either had to come from Marilyn telling someone what was happening, or that her phone was tapped by the government. The latter is the likelier choice. The document may be criticized for other reasons, but not because it is ambiguous, since the facts to be evaluated are right there in black and white. Marilyn was having a romance and sex affair over a period of time with RFK, and he had told her he would get a divorce. He was also promising, using his position as the second most powerful man in the country, to intervene in Marilyn's dispute with 20th Century Fox regarding the cancellation of her contract. He would take care of everything. Such language is proof positive that RFK was intertwined with not only the personal aspects of her life, but the business side as well. No wonder she loved him. Bobby was the perfect soulmate for her at this time, one with the power to protect her from the leeches mentioned before, and further evidence of that love is, it may be recalled, her primping for anticipated conversations with him when they met or spoke on the telephone by spending time with Dr. Greenson's wife Hildy and daughter Joan. At Marilyn's request, they schooled her on certain subjects, such as current events, that she could discuss with RFK so she could make a favorable impression with the Attorney General. Going the extra mile was her way of showing love for Bobby. This said, when one realizes the depths of dishonesty and lack of character RFK exhibited across the board, his leading Marilyn along with promises of a divorce and that he could fix her Fox contract squabble fit perfectly with the kind of unsavory man he had become. Despite being Attorney General, Bobby was still playing second fiddle to his brother, the President. But one may only imagine how not only being intimate with arguably the most beautiful woman and certainly the most famous actress in the world, as well as having her be in love with him, must have boosted RFK's ego to stratospheric proportions. Yes, he loved his wife Ethel, as Martha Donaldson had written, but he loved Marilyn, or perhaps more significantly, what she represented, the famous movie star that every man coveted as well. All the while, Marilyn stood by, wanting to believe, needing to believe RFK, that he was going to do what he said he would do, even to the extent of divorcing Ethel and thus living apart from the couple's seven children, Kathleen, Joseph II, RFK Jr., David, Courtney, Michael, and Mary Carey, each born prior to 1963. Leaving Ethel would have been one thing, but even the remote chance that Bobby, described by author C. David Heyman as loving his children, adoring them, with there being no doubt that he was a family man, would divorce and leave the children in the brink was unthinkable for a man who, despite being a serial philanderer, was devoted to his children. All this said, Marilyn must have been heartbroken when Bobby would not even accept her numerous calls to him at his office. Just imagine, the most famous entertainment personality of her era, feeling like a fool, having to act like a second-rate one-night stand who had to stoop to making call after call as she was rebuffed on a daily basis. It's certainly no stretch of the imagination to consider the image of Marilyn banging the phone receiver down as tears flowed down those beautiful cheeks of hers in agony, causing an emotional strain for a woman who so badly wanted to be loved.